Can I have your attention, please? I want to thank you all for joining us today, and I particularly want to thank BASF and Color Biotics for sponsoring our keynote event and our luncheon. So is Ken around? Ken, thank you. It's a tremendous pleasure to introduce our keynote speaker for today, and Lowell spoke to us first in 2010 in Dallas, and it took about 2 seconds for everybody to say, yes, we'd like to hear from him again, because he's an amazing speaker, economist, futurist, out of New Mexico State University, and he's got a unique way of looking at everything that we look at but never see. So it's a pleasure to introduce Lowell Catlett.
Thank you very much, Bob. Can you hear me okay in the back? Do you really care? You're sneaking out anyway. So. I appreciate the opportunity to be with you. Good afternoon. Oh, come on. It's beautiful San Antonio. It's a beautiful fall day. Come on. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Such a pleasure to be back with you folks. Usually economists don't get invited to do anything more than once other than leave the room, so thank you for letting me come back. And I'd like to add my thanks to the BASF folks and everybody for doing that. Thank you. Nothing gets done without a lot of people sacrificing and making sure it happens, so thank you. You've been very kind. Bob was very kind and didn't tell you really about me. I told you all this last time. I did grow up on a ranch in Panhandle, Texas, up in where Bob now kind of lives, except a little bit further north from there. Grew up on a ranch up there, and I had to have that fateful decision with my late father, sit down with him before I went off to college and tell him I probably wasn't destined to be a rancher. And he allowed, given my work ethic, that was probably a very wise decision. He was not upset with that. But then when he found out that I was going to be an economist, it just drove him batty, because he truly did hate economists. He thought they had no useful value. And so he was always teasing me, I thought, because he told me once that economists were those people that went in after a battle and shot the wounded. And I thought he was just joking, but you know, truly, all we do is talk about the negative. That's all we do, just talk about the negative all the time. Then he said, you know, economists exist so that meteorologists will have somebody to laugh at. Well, I thought he was joking, but pretty smart guy, you know? So, if you saw it on national news, you know, my late father's, what he said about us is really true, because somebody had the audacity to check us last year, check our accuracy of economists. So the last 10 years, they found 7,000 forecasts that we had made, just like that. 7,000 forecasts, last 10 years. We gave them a number, gave them a day. We forecast everything from unemployment rate, stock market, you name it, we forecasted. And when it was all said and done and the dust cleared and they published it nationally, our accuracy was, did you see it? 47%. You understand what I told you? You can flip a coin and beat us by 3% of coin? We don't know jack about the future. And I always loved George Patton for many reasons, but I just loved him because he said that no battle plan survives contact with the enemy. Because as soon as the bullets start flying, guess what? You're going to change the plan. But he also said this: no good general ever goes into a battle without a plan. Because we know we cannot predict, but we can kind of prepare. And if you think about that for just a second, let's talk about energy for a second, okay? This state that I grew up in has always been the number one energy producer, total, except it'll lose it this year, won't it? Okay. Number one energy producing state this year will be North Dakota. There's like three people in North Dakota. Three very rich people in North Dakota. And so I went back and I said, okay, the energy companies, I mean, they invented horizontal drilling, parabolic drilling. In the last decade, they've seen offshore platforms go from needing 60 people to operate them to 15 people to operate them, and they're drilling in three times as deep of water. They invented it all. So I said, well, wait a minute. Did they, I'm not trying to get that they could predict the future, but did they prepare? So I went back and pulled 10 years ago their annual reports to their stockholders and asked them and looked and see if any of them had said to their stockholders that one day America might be energy independent again. Not one. But if you count net energy value, we exported more energy 2 years ago than we imported. And Canada's always been a net energy exporter. Can't predict it. Could prepare for it. And I say that to say this. Nobody wants a liquefied natural gas facility that takes off liquefied natural gas in their community. Because if there's one spark, it blows. We kind of like them out in the ocean. So if it blows up, it kills three dolphins. Okay. 13 years is what it takes to get permitted to build one. We got a new one going on the East Coast, new one going down on the Gulf, 13 years on average to get the permit. Because we were bringing in a whole bunch of liquefied natural gas from the Mideast because we were gas deficit. There's a valve that's about as, almost as wide as this room is. If it's a one-way valve, it's 100,000. If it's a two-way valve, it's 200,000. 13 years to permit, both of those facilities put in which one? The one-way valve, because we're going to buy natural gas and put it in the system. To go back and retrofit, $1 billion. Because we don't take any liquefied natural gas from the world anymore, we do what? We sell it to Asia. Not trying to cast them in a bad light, I'm just trying to tell you, nobody can predict it, but damn, for 100,000. Kind of prepare for it, okay? So let me start, and those of you that remember last time, I don't have no PowerPoint, so let me explain all of this. Okay? Y'all know this, okay? But let me explain it to you. Up, down, weird as hell, okay? So let's start first and foremost with the thing that's changing everything, and it snuck up on us, okay? And it's this one, because you see it every day, and if you saw it on the cover, the USA Today, what the USA Today cover would have showed the stock market just doing what? Oh my God, this dude, everybody's just so concerned about Ebola. And what you think? 2013, the world had 195 countries that produced more than $1 billion in gross domestic product. The output of the world for 2013, last year, was the largest it's ever been in history. 70 trillion. Okay. A week ago, Federal Reserve, and they do this every month, the Federal Reserve calculates the net worth of the households in the United States. We have 121 million households in the United States. The net worth calculated a little over a week ago by the Federal Reserve was how much? Anybody see it? The world produced 70 trillion. The 121 million households in America had a collective net worth. You understand net worth? Got some assets, got some liabilities. Net. The net worth of those 121 million households was $83 trillion. The largest ever in history. In 2013, when the world produced 70 trillion, we became the world's first $17 trillion economy. China was a $7 trillion economy, its second largest. Japan was the third largest at $6 trillion. You understand what I just told you? The second and third largest economy produced $13 trillion last year. $70 trillion minus $83 trillion. The gap in what the world produced and the net worth of American households was the equivalent of the second and third largest economies in the world. There's so damn much money in this world, we cannot count it. And if you're from Canada, where's my Canadian friend? Okay. Globe and Mail reported that the average Canadian household has $65,000 more per household than the average American household. We got a bunch. You have more money than God. The largest amount of wealth ever in history. Okay. What staggers that is, that doesn't mean much, $70 trillion. But let me give you a comparison. I'll go back to 1970. Is that okay? 1970. Let me give you a comparison. The world output in 1970 was slightly less than $4 trillion. The world had 3.6 billion people in it. We could not produce enough food in 1970 for those 3.6 billion people to have every one of them have 2,450 calories each. We could not do that. Oh, we did quite nicely in the United States and Canada and a few countries, other countries. But the world could not produce enough calories, which prompted a whole group of well-meaning people to form what they called the Club of Rome and said what? Oh, the world population is just growing so fast that we won't have any resources and the price of them. We're dying. What's happened to the world's population since 1970? Not 3.6 billion people now, it's what? 7.2 billion people. It's doubled. Okay. Did you know the last decade, though? Agriculture's got so good that we produced 2,900 calories on average for every man, woman, and child. We doubled the world's population, and now guess what? Well, I'm not telling you people don't go to bed hungry. I'm just trying to tell you, guess what? It wasn't because we could not produce the food, because we produce now more than we need. And nobody said that was possible. That staggers the imagination. If you go back to 1970 for just a second with me. The second largest economy in 1970 was the UK. We became the world's first trillion-dollar economy in 1970. The second largest economy was the UK, and they produced slightly $250 billion. That $250 billion was more than the output of China, Brazil, and India combined, and they had half the world's population. Did you hear me? Second largest economy, $250 billion. Three countries that had half the world's population produced less than $250 billion. And we used to say in economics, well, damn, if the Chinese, you know, there's half a billion of them then, if they could just buy one more pair of shoes, we wouldn't have a shoe problem in the United States. And the reason they didn't was, guess what? They didn't have any money. Well, I just ran the numbers. 19-fold increase in output in China since 1970. 13-fold increase in out of India. 9-fold increase out of Brazil. They got some money now. Don't think that's important? 7-fold increase in the number of window air conditioning units that went to China in the last 5 years. 5-fold increase in India. Enough people got enough money in both those countries that basically said, hell, we're tired of being hot. India is not a country known culturally or religiously for eating beef. I just ran the numbers for the Beef Council. Beef product consumption in India has doubled in the last 5 years. In a country not known culturally or religiously for eating beef, it doubled. Now, if Indians got enough money, they basically said, we're trying a cow. Don't think that's important, folks. When you go from basic subsistence, what's the next? When you get a little bit more money, what starts happening? People want to change their diet, and they want to change their diet from meat protein. We think the world may go to 9 billion people. We don't know, but if it does go to 9 billion people, we've calculated the numbers by 2050. If it goes to 9 billion people, we will have to double meat protein production to meet that demand. Because when people get more money around the world, first thing they change is their diet. First diet they change is they want more meat protein. It's not going to be done by pastoral agriculture. Pastoral agriculture is, well, I like to see those Holsteins, those beautiful black and white cows grazing on the side of the hills in Vermont.
They are, they're beautiful.
You're going to double meat protein, it ain't going to be done there. It's going to be done in intensive animal operations, folks. Okay? And we will change those, but it'll be done in intensive animal operations. Because guess what? Their health is better. Their output is staggeringly more efficient. Okay? And guess what? When we have to sell meat protein now, not based upon just price, but on carbon credits per pound, the only groups that can meet those is not pastoral agriculture. It is intensive animal operations. So get ready in your communities that there are only a few countries that can meet those demands. Okay? That's powerful. Okay? It's phenomenal. Okay? Because as the world gets richer, they want a bunch of stuff that we have. Okay? Not wrong or right. And with the kind of wealth we got in this country, it drives us to be weird as hell. 20 years ago, we didn't measure organic. Organic is now what? 4% and growing. Didn't measure this one 10 years ago. Gluten-free. You understand, hard medical evidence says 0.5% of the population has any form of celiac disease. 0.5%. Any form of it, but it's 1.7% of the food sector and growing. As a friend of mine said, well, all I know, I don't have any gluten-free problems. I don't have celiac disease. I just feel better when I eat gluten-free. You feel better because you didn't eat 3 loaves of bread at dinner. So you get a bunch of money that we've got and we become very picky. We become very differentiated in the food. We want what? Cage-free eggs. Free-range chicken. I grew up on a ranch. We had free range chicken. Follow them. Watch what they eat. I'll take mine raised on corn and soybeans. Thank you very much. Not wrong or right. I'm just trying to tell you, you got a world that's got $83 trillion in net worth. Basically, people start saying, what? I want it gluten free, organic. And oh, by the way, don't insult me with a Budweiser. Please, I want a local craft brew. In 1970, there were no craft brew producers in the United States. There's 4,000 now. And have you seen the latest one? Organic vodka. What? Like 90 proof, it's gonna kill every damn thing in the bottle. But I met the lady in Kentucky. She said, "Lloyd, you can tease me all day long, but I'm pushing production people as hard as I possibly can because I can sell 10 times more than I can get produced." I said, "Who in the hell is buying organic?" And her comment was, "Mostly people that go to spas." My mom in May turned 87, and she still lives on a ranch in Van Hill, Texas, near a place called Clarington. 13-year breast cancer survivor.
Nice.
Both knees replaced. And I guarantee you, in about February, March of this year, she was doing what ranch people did in Van Hill, Texas. She was out breaking ice so that the cattle could get water. Let me ask you something. I think she's ever been to a spa. I'm not making light of spas, please don't get me wrong. I'm just trying to tell you, guess what? Markets that didn't exist all of a sudden when you got a little bit of money and the most phenomenal wealth that's ever existed, guess what? It staggered the imagination. Someone reminded me that when I spoke to you last time, I talked about the amount of wealth that's going to be transferred. Let me tell you about that $83 trillion, okay? 2/3 of it is owned by baby boomers. My generation. I don't like to quote one study, but this was a good study, so I'll quote one study of it, okay? The oldest of my generation is now, we believe, 46, so we're getting to be in our late 60s. But the one study said that 1 in 10 of us by age 65 has Alzheimer's. What are we talking about? So, you're going to have, very quickly, folks, two-thirds of that wealth. And one economist said it's not going to be $83 trillion by the time it is dissipated. It will be $153 trillion. The largest amount of intergenerational transfer of wealth that's ever occurred. If you are part of a family business, understand the numbers. In the United States, and I'll give them both for the United States and Canada, because it's even worse in Canada, okay, or good, depending on how you look at it. To survive the second generation in the United States from a family business, 20% due. Did you hear me? 20% survived second generation. 4% survived the third generation. Canadian Business Council says in Canada it is 10% and 2%. If you think you're going to leave it to your son or daughter, there's a high probability it ain't going to be there. And I'm not picking on your sons and daughters. I'm just trying to tell you, guess what? The reality is you're going to have a whole bunch of money start transferring, or a whole bunch of money that's going to have to be spent philanthropically, and baby boomers are weird as hell. So let me zero in, though, and just leave that as something to think about. Zero in, though, on the next two generations real quick, because if we get Alzheimer's and we not only can't find our car in the parking lot, but we have no idea what company we're working for, then you're probably going to fire ass, okay? And you should, okay? So you could, we're getting to that point where, whatever reason, we don't know, okay? But the generation, and there's 82 million of us still, but the generation that came afterwards, the Xers, 44 million. Now, if something kind of works in economics, we call it an axiom. If it works more than kind of, we call it a law. Okay? We ain't got many of them. One of the laws we got is if prices are high, you can generally bet quantities what? Low. Vice versa. You with me? Pretty good law. Okay. So we birthed the smallest generation, so there's 44 million Xers. Many of you in this room, I can tell by the looks of you, 44 million of you. You know, you were born in the mid to the late 60s to the mid to the late 80s. Pick whatever number you want to. It doesn't matter. Whichever generation you want to pick. But there's only 44 million of you. Let me tell you why that's important. First job I took in New Mexico State University in 1978 is young assistant prof, baby boom generation. There's 200 applicants for the job. My startup package, the department head said, I'll pay up to $300 for a U-Haul to get your junk out of Iowa. The last plant pathologist I hired at New Mexico State University, I paid her the market, $90,000. That wasn't the point. There were seven applicants for the position. Five of them were good. Not too many applicants. Okay. Her startup package was $250,000. It wasn't the salary that differentiated whether I got it or not. It was her startup package. And that's at New Mexico State University. I can imagine at North Carolina, Bill, it's a half a million or higher for some of them. Okay. Startup package. They are, at this point in their career, the highest paid generation ever in history. So when you start firing us, because we don't know what building we're in, you better grab your wallet, because you're going to replace him with the smallest generation, and you're going to pay for it. Okay? But so let's leave them alone, because they're going to have more money than maybe more money than Canadians, if that's possible. Okay? But this Y generation is the one that's getting the worst rap, and I love this generation. This generation was born, folks, in that late 80s to the early 2000s. We got another generation starting. We haven't figured out a name for them yet, but ignore that. We got 75, 76 million of this generation, pretty good sized generation, and they're getting a bad rap. So let me zero in on them for just a second, because they're important to you, okay? They're the generation that's never known life without this, okay? And they're getting a bad rap. You understand?
Well, wasn't it nice to be able to walk down the street and look people in the eye? And now all they're doing is just...
That's all they do. And then when you ask them, what are you looking at? Susie's eating a pickle. So we say to them, you're the me generation. Au contraire. My generation was the first me generation. We protested on college campuses. We smoked dope. We did drugs. We still do drugs. Except that Prozac and Metamucil, but we're still. So they're calling me, but guess what? And they said, well, all they do is spend their time on social networking. Well, let me tell you about why you need to embrace this generation and understand it. And I want to pick up Hannah Boyd's book, because she's a researcher at Microsoft. It's called It's Complicated, Communicating with the Connected Teenager. Okay? And her research was brilliant because she pointed out this. Yeah, they do spend a whole bunch of time on social networking. But you know what? It's because we make them do it that way. What? I don't make them do that. Oh, really? As my wife pointed out to me. In Las Cruces, when she was growing up with six brothers and sisters, Las Cruces at that time was 35,000 or so. She said, when we all those kids got home at 3:30 in the afternoon from school, my mom had no idea where we were until supper at 6:30. I got on my bike and I rode all over Las Cruces, New Mexico, and so did my older sister, and so did all my brothers. And we thought nothing of it. She didn't know where we were until 6:30 for supper. We knew damn well we'd be there at 6:30 for supper. But she had no idea where we were for 3 hours. Would you let your 10-year-old daughter get on a bicycle and ride through your community today for 3 hours and not know where she is? You'd hope you'd live in that kind of a community where you could, but the answer is no. So what Hannah Boyd's research found out was, guess what? This is the safest way that we let them do what we did, because, guarantee you, my wife probably had Susie, her friend, tell her she was eating a pickle, or she didn't have to because she saw it. But in this world, you have to explain it. Okay? So guess what, folks? They are real good at social networking because we made them do it. And oh, here's the big one. You might want to get ready for this one, because guess what? Her research shows this. They go to sporting events not necessarily because they like sports, but because that's the only other venue that is safe for them where they can see their friends face to face. And they do like face to face. But the only place we let them do it is what? Well, we can drop them off at the football game or the basketball game, and guess what? Feel safe that they're around friends, and that's a safe environment. Hannah Boyd's book, it's complicated. You might want to pick it up. She explains them real well. My point is, guess what? My generation gladly pays $100 million for an 18-year-old to play shortstop, because guess what? We think nothing of paying $100 for a ticket and $13 for a beer. How about that generation? They go to a sporting event not because they like it, but because guess what? It's the way they meet friends. The single largest sporting and entertainment venue last year, last fall, was at the Staples Center in Los Angeles. Not because it helped the most. It sold out in 4 minutes. It was the gaming championship of the world between the gamers, the team from South Korea and China. Oh, what made it the largest one was? It sold out in 4 minutes, because I guarantee it, every damn one of them was a nerd. And they had set their smartphones for what? Buy the ticket, what? At 12:01? 4 minutes. What made it the largest was 20 million participated with their smart device or their computer worldwide in the Game Off Championships. They're probably not going to support college football and baseball and pro sports the same way we did. I'm not saying it's wrong or right, I'm just trying to tell you, get ready for a generation. Let me tell you why. Take advantage of this knowledge, okay? If I gave you the name of this company, I guarantee there ain't a person in this room that would not recognize the name. Guarantee, okay? Signed a non-disclosure with them. I did get approval from the executive vice president to tell you the story, though, okay? And it is this. They thought that they would. They make a thing, a lot of things. They're very good, and they have manufacturing all over the world, and they have service and parts. Are you with me? It's a thing, and anyway, okay. So they said, you know what? We want to build a seamless system. It'll have to be mobile, wireless, between the equipment and our manufacturing and our service and our parts so that it's seamless, so that downtime is what? Almost non-existent, that the performance of the product is what? Stellar. So we want to build a system and it's going to be wireless, and they spent $100 million. And the executive vice president that's telling me the story said, and I showed up at the first dealer that agreed to be the beta tester. And as I'm walking and approaching the service manager's desk, there's a customer standing there, and he and the service manager are looking at his smartphone. It seems the customer's son, a teenager, wrote an app that connected the equipment and did exactly what they had, except it went into his son's Facebook, and then the service manager pulled it out of his Facebook, and the problem was solved. I said, what did you do? And he said, when I picked myself up off the floor, I realized we had just spent $100 million for nothing. I said, let me ask you something, though. How many millennials did you have on your focus group? And the answer was, how many? This is second nature to them. They do public platforms. They know inside and out. You might want to embrace them because they might save you $100 million. And as a young millennial, I was telling a group of us, there's probably just two tables of us for this executive forum that I was at a few months ago in Denver, and this young millennial was up there, and he picked on me because he thought I was obviously the oldest person in the group. He said, how old were you when you had your first job? And I said, I don't know. I grew up on a ranch. Three? I don't know. But all I remember was my dad putting me on the back of my horse and saying, don't let those cows get through that way. I don't know. So he wasn't going to get a straight answer out of me because I didn't know. So he turned to the next guy, how old were you when you had your first job? And he says, I don't know, 12, 13, I had a paper route. He said, I'll tell you for you baby boomers, average age for your first job, 12. Did you screw up, he said to the guy. He said, yeah, first snowstorm we had, I took all the papers and threw them in the dumpster. He said, little did it dawn on me, these were all the neighbors, and they knew my mom and dad. And so I spent the rest of the day dumpster diving and them following me, making sure I got those papers delivered. Yeah, I screwed up. He said, but by 16, you're a pretty good hand, weren't you? And we all kind of go, yeah, probably by 16. Because we'd had several years of what?
Practice.
Screwing up. He said, let me tell you about my generation. Our average first job is 22. We're starting to learn at age 22 what you started learning at 12. And he gave him a good message. He said to us this, please be patient with us. We will learn it, but we're learning it from a different age and a different platform. But just like you, we will learn it. Okay? Be patient with us. Okay? And oh, by the way, they know this stuff real good. A few months ago, listening to a chief of police in California, smaller community in California, he said, let me tell you, he said, I just came from a department that was 10 times larger. I'm chief of police now, this smaller department, so I could make some changes. He said, in the department that I came from in a large city in California, 10 times larger, we had one public information officer. And everything is hierarchical. Everything had to pass through because it's very militaristic, because, you know, if you have something, then it compromises, it might compromise the investigation. And so there's very little information that we can give out. And so very little got to the public. So guess what? The public perception of the police department was not good. He said, so when I became chief of police in a department one-tenth the size, I got 7 public information officers. I got one for Pinterest. I got one for Facebook. I got one for Instagram. He starts naming them. I'm going, I didn't have any service on these acronyms. I don't know. He said, so we all got together and decided in investigations, what information can we give to the public that does not in any way compromise our police work? And we found out that it was about 95% that we could share with the public. And when we shared that information, guess what happens to the public's Guess what it made us look like? Transparent, open. We gave you as much information as we possibly could. We protected very little, all we needed for the investigation. He said, guess what happened to the public's attitude about my police department? He said, but let me give you one example. We had a routine traffic stop. Obvious from the stop that drugs were involved. So we went through the proper channels so we could search the vehicle because the officer saw laying on the back seat a very expensive, what appeared to be a very expensive piece of jewelry, which didn't match the occupants of the car. So we figured, well, gee, when it turned out to be a very expensive piece of jewelry, figure all of our databases, FBI, national, state, everything, we could find this thing and it would be stolen and hot, and we couldn't. But my Pinterest officer, information officer, took a picture of it, several of them, posted it on Pinterest, and 24 hours, we had a heir of the family. It seemed it had been stolen on the East Coast 22 years prior. Solved in 24 hours by Pinterest. Embrace them, folks. They're real smart. They know this stuff instinctively. Okay? And oh, is this thing going to be vital to the future? Because did you see it? Qualcomm just announced a $10 million XPRIZE for the device that will fit on a Galaxy or the iPhone that will most mimic a tricorder. Anybody old enough to know what the hell a tricorder is?
Yeah.
Gotta be a Trekkie fan to know what a tricorder is. Tricorder in Star Trek does camera everything. Okay? You know? It's what bones use to determine, well, you got a broken bone, you're an alien, your blood is green. What Spock used to determine whether the atmosphere is, it solved everything. So Qualcomm, $10 million prize for the device that will most mimic a tricorder. There's six odds on favorites. Let me just tell you about a couple of the first ones. One is this, snap it on it, so it's still a cell phone, but will it mimic a tricorder as much as possible? The odds on favorite is this one. It's got a little micro cavity here. You put a drop of blood in it, all you need is really a molecule. You put a drop in there, it does an instant red blood cell count, white blood cell count. It will do an instant analysis of whether you're HIV positive. If you're on blood thinners, it does an instant INR. You name it, you specify, and it will measure. That's already here. That's probably the odds on favorite to claim most of it, okay? That's already here. Okay. And the next one is change the lens in this. Put in a molecular lens, molecule of oil and water. Electrical impulses change the focus 60 times a second. Then we add a near-infrared laser, and then you shine it on the blemish on your skin. The near-infrared laser goes underneath the skin about a quarter of an inch. Black and white algorithm does the patterns of light and dark, and it will tell you instantly whether your blemish is benign or cancerous. Folks, get ready for a revolution in do-it-yourself diagnostics. That's going to blow healthcare out. Okay. Gentleman in Dallas a few weeks ago showed me this one. Bionically puts his index finger over the camera lens, positively identifies him, turns around, all his heart data. I said, what's it mean? He said, I have no idea. All I know is my cardiologist said, do it 5 times a day. Your cardiologist gets this information 5 times a day. He says, no, well, you know what's happening. It's going into a central computer. The computer intelligent default is sorted to it. If there's a problem, then the cardiologist gets the information or a text or I get it. If you're my age, you go to a cardiologist once a year, one data point. How about 5 a day? Folks, get ready for a revolution in do-it-yourself diagnostics. Why is that important? We know this because it's true in both Canada and the United States. 85% of all healthcare costs are behaviorally related. They're not because you got a disease, not because you got cancer. They are, did you hear me? Behaviorally related. And guess what? You got devices now that will do what? Lowell, don't even look at another state today. Gonna find fundamentally change everything. Okay? Already here. One final thing on this before I leave it is, interesting thing about Amazon, it's a great case study. Amazon said what? We want to ship you books faster and cheaper than anybody in the world. Okay? And they did. Great model, didn't it? But they also found that platform for books works what? Equally well for what?
Everything.
And so you know that Amazon retail is larger than all other online retail in the United States combined. Okay? Started out trying to sell you a book. And it's important because the average American only reads 2 books a year. But that platform works real good. But then Amazon said what? Well, damn, if we can get you a book cheaper and faster, why don't we just take a 20-year-old technology called e-ink and do what? Instead of shipping you a book, why don't we just ship you what? A digital version of it. What do you think the American Library Association said when they talked about digital books first coming out, even though it's 20-year-old technology?
Well, we really, you know, they're nice, but we think people will always like the heft and the feel of a book.
Really? Let's see. 3,500 books? And if I don't have one in here, I can get one in what? Less than a minute? Think I wouldn't like that? 25% now of all university textbooks. I had this conversation with a chemistry prof not too long ago. It wasn't really a conversation. It's kind of an argument. He goes,
well, all in economics, of course, you've not had an arithmetic in 30 years. Yes, you can have an evil. But in chemistry, we need very complicated, colorful text to show what's going on.
I said, really? Let's see. In my ebook, I get to the part about adding a base to an acid, and I can read it, but underneath it is a hyperlink. And I can hit that hyperlink in a world-class professor, in a world-class laboratory, in any language I choose to speak, comes on board and shows me what happens when you add a base to an acid. Think I might like that? What do we do in education, folks? We do exactly what we're doing today, and I love it, I'm part of it. But get ready for a revolution. What do we do in education? Somebody stands up and pontificates and professes. You sit passively and absorb. I send you home with homework to make sure you were texting while I was talking. It's a great model. What about this model? You get the lecture anytime, any place, anywhere. And you come to class, and we do the homework. For those involved in education understand it, something that good teachers have done for a long, long time is called flipping. And I'll go out on a limb and tell you this, in the flipped model, I don't need your sons and daughters and nieces and nephews 4 years to get them a college degree. I need them 2. Okay. And folks, at $36,000 on average for all private and public schools now for a year, counting living expenses, I can save you 2. And besides, you really don't give a rip if we have a good football team tonight. Oh, get ready, folks. It's going to change the face of education. Not wrong or right, but it's sure going to change it. Okay? Powerful implications for you. But let me leave you the one that I think you've got to get ready for. And you know it because many of you are probably doing it as you start and build. Tried to get you talking about blends and all those kind of things, but guess what? And you've read about it and you've seen about it, okay? And we call it by many names. Some of them call it additive manufacturing, but 3D printing is changing everything. And I know you're sitting there going, well, it doesn't really pertain to soil or mulch. Folks, we printed 3 years ago hamburger meat in Amsterdam. It was taste tested 2 years ago in the UK. And they all agreed it tasted like hell, but it was printed. And last year, leather was printed, And it went through the same tanning process. It was on national news, and people that were leather experts could not distinguish the printed leather from the real one. So you got additive manufacturing, 3D printing. You understand the power of the digital. I say it this way, folks. In this new world, if it can be digitized, it will be. You think about any process you have, if we can digitize it, get on the leading edge of it. If you want to be a bank and say, well, no, we won't. Let me give you the hard numbers from the American Banking Association, because I sat on a bank board for many years, and I know how tough it is to move the tide, but I guarantee you this. Branches, because we want you, you want a branch in your community because you like to have a little branch in your community, the bricks and mortar. What's been the use of bricks and mortars for the last 5 years? It's down 40%. Cost up 65%. You're building bricks and mortar to this generation? Folks, if they can't do it mobile, they ain't doing it. Think of any process you got, if it can be digitized, somebody's going to do it. Get ready for 3D printing, because if somebody can print something, get ready. They're going to change the face of everything. Okay. When I spoke to the American Manufacturing Association, a gentleman came up afterwards last year, and he said, thank you for talking about 3D printing. We've got a whole bunch of people in there that spend billions of dollars on all this equipment, and they don't think 3D printing is here for real. He said, thank you. He hands me a little hard, white plastic, I know it by its trade name, but it wasn't this. A crescent, you know, an adjustable wrench, you know what I'm talking about? Any of you gearhead? Okay. It's hard plastic. He said, trust me, it's as hard as metal. You can use it. I said, okay, how many pieces did you have to print to snap this together to give me this fully working little adjustable wrench? He said, duh, Lowell, it's a 3D printer where you put it down, and if there's a gap, it doesn't print. It was printed fully working. And he said, oh, by the way, I printed it this morning in my hotel. Okay. Last month, did you see, it took him 44 hours at a major technology conference, but a fully functioning car was printed and drove off of the show floor. China claims that they printed 10 homes this year from industrial waste in 4 hours. I've seen pictures of their 3D printer for homes. It's about the size of this room. And it fully does print a home, one home, in 4 hours. They claim they built 10 out of industrial waste in the same amount of time. Folks, if it can be printed, you better get ready for revolution, because it's coming. It staggers the imagination. And bionically, oh, I love this one. The Mahuta Foundation just announced the X Prize for the first printed liver, fully functioning, that when transferred into a large mammal will survive and function as a liver for 90 days. Again, there's 6 teams that probably will claim it, certainly by mid part of next year. A fully functioning printed liver, and when you drink as much as I do, thank God, I hope they do that. So it's not just hard things, folks, it's what? Anything bionically. And with the Ebola scare, let me tell you, it may have put the CDC, I don't know whether it's the CDC. All that we know is at the beginning of this year, a major project was announced, and it was going to be with a government agency. I can't imagine it being anything other than the CDC, but they kind of got their hands full right now. But Ebola is exactly the reason that they wanted this thing to come on board, and this was before Ebola became a word that everybody knew. But what they wanted was this, and the project was going to be done, and it will be done. It may have already been done. We don't know for sure. But a government agency, the Synthetic Genomics Group, and the J. Craig Venter Genomics Group, and J. Craig Venter Group was part of helping unwind the DNA helix for the humans, okay? Those three groups and entities will be given this project this year. A plane has already been outfitted with the equipment. A group of scientists will be identified. They will board the plane before the door is closed. They will be given a vial of a deadly biome, probably a flu virus that if you are weak and have a weak immune system would kill you. The door will be closed. The plane will take off, probably circle, but it'll fly for 4 hours. The team of scientists must, in that 4 hours, identify what the biome is, and then on board is a bionic 3D vaccine printer that will print 100 vials of a vaccine so that when they land, they can start inoculation. Gone will be pandemics and epidemics, all because, guess what? You're printing bionic material. I don't know what that's going to do to mulch and soil, but get ready, folks. It will give you a controlled environment, and it may be part of what you're thinking about doing. If you doubt it, understand Home Depot has already said that they do not want me to come to their store anymore, which is tragic because my wife says that Lowe's and Home Depot are my mistresses. Because I go into one of those stores and I just go into sub-hypnotic trance. Damn, look at those pliers. They're dipped in rubber. I didn't know I needed those. I don't! Why are you here to buy a pair than to look for a pair? Okay. But what Home Depot wants is this. I'm being a little bit facetious when I say they don't want me in the store. They just don't want to stockpile all that stuff. What they want to do is say the 3D printer and say the raw materials. And then if I need a number 5 washer to keep the screen door from banging, guess what? I don't go buy a bubble pack of 20. I just do what? I make it on site. That's what Home Depot's vision is for parts and supply. And they got a 3-2 box. Get ready for that. But the real revolution that impacts you guys the most, and I'm going to leave with ungodly amounts of wealth and money in this country, but this one probably indirectly has the most, okay? Because it gets to plants. And you're going, God, he talked already. We know this. Married men live on average 3 years longer than single men, okay? We know that. Single men do not live very long. You know the reason a single man doesn't live very long. Last thing a single man says before he dies, hold my beer and watch this. Single men do not live very long. Married men get what's called the marriage premium. Women do not get it. We tease you and say you live forever, okay? But what we found now in science in the last year is this, okay? We ask you, name as fast as you can, closest male, your closest friend.
My brother.
Yeah. You named your brother. The typical answer by a man is, we name our spouse. Closest friend. No, you can't name your spouse. What's the second name we get? Our dog. Men name instinctively our two closest friends, our spouse and our dog. No, you can't name your spouse. Name as fast as you can, close male friends, and we're speechless. We struggle. Oh, I think George likes me. I don't know. We struggle. We name three. We ask women, name as fast as you can, close female friends. You can't shut up. And the time it takes us to name three, you name ten. You already have what we call rich and deep social connections. And you kind of go, well, we'll be. Well, let me tell you the science behind all of that, okay? And if you subscribe to a magazine called Men's Health, just a few months ago in the corner it said, forget going to your cardiologist. How many friends do you have? It seems that matters a hell of a lot. Okay? So let me give you some hard other science. This one we studied from women that had gone through the most difficult child labor on the planet, living hell, I'm told. I have no desire to do this. But the moment that new infant is put in their bosom, instinctively, almost all women, they've just gone through living hell. They smile. It's life. Okay?
And we always said, well, it's the mother-child bond.
Well, yeah. But we also know this. They're called bonding chemicals. And to date, we've identified over 100 of them. They're steroids, which means, guess what? They're part of your body's immune system. The most prevalent one is one called oxytocin. And if you know anything about oxytocin, it just makes you giddy. My wife and I have been married 30 years. All I know is when I'm in her presence, I'm just giddy as hell. And when I'm not, I drink. Either way, I'm giddy as hell. So to add science to it, we said, well, yeah, they're bonding chemicals. So we went back and pulled out hundreds of long-term epidemiological studies, and we zeroed in on 114 because they had measured something but didn't think it was important at the time. They measured this. Do you have rich and deep social connections? Are you the unibomber? Okay. Do you not? 114 long-term epidemiological studies, and it was staggering, the results. And it was this. You have rich and deep social connections. You died in those 114 studies from all causes at 1/4 the rate of those that did not. It is mathematically 100% totally reciprocal, which means you don't have rich and deep social connections, you will die from all causes at 4 times the rate of those that do. Carnegie Mellon said, well, does it work for infections? And they found almost identical results, and they found this. All forms of infections, if you have rich and deep social connections, you get them at 1/2 the rate of those that do. People matter. And they matter a hell of a lot. Okay. Current head of the American Hospital Association is a guy by the name of Jim Hinton, and he runs the Presbyterian healthcare system in New Mexico. He didn't invent it, but he has endorsed it in the Presbyterian system in New Mexico because they started something called Hospitals at Home. And the idea is, for many things, almost 90% of you coming to an acute care facility, what we can do if you want to, and they do go through a system, they take a hospital bed to your home and they arrange for the specialist and the healthcare to come to your home. And guess what happens to healthcare outcomes? Guess what happens to healthcare cost? People matter. Every day the walls fall. Called bonding chemicals. Okay. Staggers the imagination. I'll give you one little side thing, not important to any of you, but I think it's important. Okay. Generally, if you know premature babies, what we've done, great success in premature babies over the years, okay? In longevity and health over the time. Great strides. But what do we do with them when they're premature? They have no immune system, so what do we do with them? We keep them isolated in an incubator. And they will spend 5 months on average in that facility. Okay? An Australian medical doctor studying kangaroos found out that a roo is birthed and stays in the pouch next to the mother and emerges at various times, not totally always, but by age, they emerge from the pouch when what? Their immune system is strong enough for them to live outside the pouch. Gee, why? What are they getting while they're next to the mother roo? All of the what? Bonding chemicals. Incidentally, kangaroos are the only mammal species we know that when times get tough, their whole body can reabsorb the fetus to save the mother's life. Okay. It rarely occurs except in terribly distressed environmental conditions, but they can do it. Okay. So he started a process, and it's known as kangaroo therapy. He said, why don't we do that in our premature babies? We have to protect them, but we've got to build their immune system. And so for protective periods of time, they are put in their mother's bosom. They also found, guess what? The father works equally as well. They just need to be in contact with the human. It's called kangaroo therapy. And if any of you know and have healthcare providers that know it or work with it, it takes it down from an average of 5 months to 5 weeks.
friend of mine, Chuck Eggert, that runs Pacific Foods right outside of Oregon, runs organic dairies. The death rate on young male calves in our dairies in the United States is 30%. Nobody wants a male calf in a dairy. So we isolate them immediately, and we put them in crates, and the death rate nationally is 30%. And he got a young herdsman from Colombia that had read about kangarooing for humans, and he said to Chuck, "I won't bankrupt you, but let me take your male calves. I'll take 10 of them. They're herd creatures. I'm going to throw 10 of them together." And Chuck said, "They have no immune system. They will, the diseases will run rampant." He said, "I'm not going to bankrupt you. At most, you'll have a death rate of those 10. And guess where Chuck Eggert's death rate is now? That's not why I'm telling you that. Okay? It takes about 30 minutes for those bonding chemicals to work when you're around a human. So if you're around somebody that you like, typically your children, but not always. Okay? You're around your spouse or significant other, but not always. Okay? It takes about 30 minutes. Okay? This is a nice room, but it's sterile. What do you think would happen if we took some nice soil mediums and just filled this room with plants? It takes 20 minutes for those bonding chemicals to kick in with humans when they're around a plant. Not 30 with humans, 20. Smart architects are now designing commercial spaces and manufacturing facilities to include what? Put the damn plants in, okay? Because it matters on your immune system, okay? Totally matters, okay? And that matters to you because I guarantee you, as we redefine the spaces, and who's going to redefine them? It isn't going to be old duffers like me. It's going to be what's going to happen. They're going to want a bunch of plants, so get ready. And animal science just found out, guess what? Same thing about plants. I told you last time about my Chesapeake Bay Retriever. Most wonderful creature other than my wife that I've ever lived with. I will tell you this, though. Lived on this earth 15 years and 60 days. In the last few weeks of her life, when the veterinary told us to just take her home and love her even more than we possibly could at that time, we did. She would be very unsettled. My wife and I would lay down instinctively on the bed with her and put her arm around her. And in a few minutes, her breathing would ease and she would go to sleep. And so would we. We thought we were just helping. What do you think in the last year animal science has found out? Just like plants, about 20 minutes with a pet you like, and the bonding chemicals start doing what? We thought we were helping her. And she was just as much unknowingly what? You want to have healthy people. Can't separate them from people and plants and animals. You're at the heart of that. The demand for what you do. Thanks for letting me come back.